Hello and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm one of your hosts here, Dana Azban, here with my friend Chavruta and Gordon. Our daf today, Masechta Bava Metzia, daf hey, page 5. Well, pretty much since we began this Masechta, we've been dealing with Rabbi Chiya and his Kal V'chomer, and we've been introduced to a concept from Rabbi Chiya of Moda B'miksat. The idea being that if you can partially substantiate a claim by witnesses, it creates a scenario of moda b'miksat, which is a way of sort of proving that maybe the claim is actually true, all right? Or at least that you can substantiate that part of the claim is true. And so what begins to finally happen on this daf is, after we've done all of this work on what is Rabbi Chiya's opinion, how does he develop a kal v'chomer, different proofs for it, different ways of understanding it, we finally have a case. And the Gemara wants to work through this case and see if Rabbi Chiya's understanding of moda b'miksat with witnesses applies here. Hahu raya. So there was a shepherd. Dehave masar le kol yom achivata besade. So every day, like the people who lived wherever he lived, right, they would, in front of witnesses, would give him animals each day, right? So the idea is that people would drop his animals off and there were witnesses to see that the animals were there. And this way, when they came back at the end of the day to take the animals back, the witnesses could say, hey, this person gave you their sheep, this person gave you their sheep. He wouldn't be able to say, he wouldn't be able to steal any of the animals. Yom achad masrule below sade. One day they delivered witnesses to him without any witnesses. L'sofam ralehu. And then at the end of that day, when people came to get their animals back, he says, lo hayu dvarim me'olam. This never happened. And there were no witnesses that day to say that those animals were delivered. Atu sade asidu bay. But witnesses did come and testify, de'achol tarte minhu, that he ate two of the animals that day. So that basically establishes that he did receive at least two of the animals that people, of all the animals that people claim that he had. So Rabbi Zera looks at this case and he says, I'm a Rabbi Zera. Im ita lida Rabbi Chiya kamate. If Rabbi Chiya's first law is accepted, right, the idea that you can have moda b'miksat, situation because you have a partial substantiation by witnesses, mishtava ashrai, then he has to swear with about the remaining animals, right? Because in other words, the shepherd basically has to say, you know, he has to basically deny that he didn't get any of those other animals. The witnesses say, hey, you got those two animals. They were given to you to eat. He ate them. Or, you know, or he has to pay them back because he actually was supposed to shepherd them and he ate them, fine. But that is because there's a moda b'miksat situation here, because the witnesses can substantiate that he did receive some animals. He now has to take a shvua to basically say, I don't know anything about the other animals that everybody's claiming. Now, Abaye doesn't agree with this. Amar le Abaye. Abaye says to Rabbi Zera, im atay mishtaba, if Rabbi Chiya's first, you know, if Rabbi Chiya's opinion is accepted, the shepherd swears, right? How could this be? V'ha gazlan hu. Really, he's a thief, and a thief doesn't ever actually take an oath. In other words, what we know is that the shepherd basically stole two of the animals, right? We know that because it was established by witnesses who saw him eating it. So he's disqualified from actually swearing. What Rabbi is trying to say is that when we have Rabbi Chiya's law here, that if you have a partial substantiation by witnesses, it's considered moda b'miksat, right? It's where his claim, his denial of the claim, right, is only partially contradicted by the witnesses, right? So for example, let's say somebody says, you owe me 100 zoos, right? And the defendant come and he says, you know, no, I don't owe you anything. And then witnesses come and say, no, you actually owed 50 zoos. So it's possible in that case, he didn't actually mean to say that he didn't want to pay anything at all, but he's just stalling so that he could eventually find the money to pay what he could pay, right? Or if a litigant, you know, denies actually receiving an object that he was supposed to watch, and then witnesses come and say, you know, no, he did receive, you know, let's say he was given two objects, right? And then witnesses come and say he was given at least one. It doesn't mean that he actually stole it, right? It could mean that maybe the other object was lost. Or again, he's stalling for time so he can pay the owner back. But this case of the shepherd, He's like outright lying. He's saying nobody gave him anything, right? Like he's outright lying that anything happened. And there's no way to explain it. So that's what Abaye is saying. Like, he's just a thief. So why? And we know that in those cases, he doesn't act, and a thief never takes an oath. So Rabbi Zeir is going to clarify what he wants to say. Amar Leh, so Rabbi Zeir says to Abaye, Shekenegdo Kamane. I meant to say his opponent swears. In other words, what it calls for is that the shepherd, he's not going to actually swear, but actually the plaintiff has to swear. In other words, the people who dropped off the animals, the owners, they have to swear that they actually dropped off those animals. So the Gemara wants to explore this a little bit more and basically say to Rabbi Zeira, why do you need Rabbi Chia, right? Hashtanami delete de Rabbi Chia. But even if, you know, we say Rabbi Chia, we don't accept what he had to say. Nechave means a Rav Nachman. We can say that somebody has to swear because of Rav Nachman's ruling. Why? Ditnan. We learned in a Mishnah, mana li biyatcha, right? If somebody says, you owe me a mana, and then the defendant says, ein lecha biyadi, I don't owe you anything. Patur, he's exempt. He doesn't have to swear. Va'ama Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman comes after seeing this particular Mishnah. This is a Mishnah in Shvuyot on page Lamed Chet on 38, right? In other words, the idea is that the defendant denies the entire claim. He doesn't have to take a shvuah at all, okay? So, but Rav Nachman says, Mishbiino to shvuat hesait, right? There's a rabbinic enactment here. There's a rabbinic takana here that we make him take a shvuat hesait, which basically means an oath of incitement. And the idea here is the defendant who denies an entire claim against him, right? From a deoraita level, biblically, he does not need to swear. But later on, the rabbis sort of made him swear. It's called a shvuah hesed to sort of try to incite him to admit the claim if it is true, right? Because the idea there is that they still want to try to get him or sort of force him to take a shvuah, with the idea being that nobody, that first of all, it would sort of, because there's going to be the shvuah, right? We'd, you know, the plaintiff would sort of make sure that the plaintiff wouldn't sort of just make a claim that wasn't true, right? So the rabbis wanted to make sure that, and also we want to make sure that the defendant isn't lying in a way. So the rabbis still wanted the defendant to take an oath. So either this will make the defendant admit his debt, you know, that he owes something rather than having to swear falsely, or it establishes some credibility to him that he denies because he actually agreed to take the oath. So their point here is you don't even need Rabbi Chia, Rabbi Zeira. You can just use the case of Rav Nachman. Like, you don't need to talk about Rabbi Chia at all. So Rav Chia takantaki. So the Gemara says that this oath that Rav Nachman is talking about is it's a takana of the rabbis, right? The takanta l'takanta lo avidinan, right? But we don't have one enactment after another. So therefore, if we just adopt Rabbi Chia's ruling, right, that in other words, the shepherd has to take an oath, a shvuah, because of moda mimiksat, okay, then how could we say that the oath actually goes to the townspeople? In other words, it doesn't really make sense when you invoke this thing of Rav Nachman, right? We can't say that we're shifting the oath, right, from the defendant to the plaintiff is rabbinic, okay? But you can't then say, but therefore you can't say that the initial oath itself is rabbinic. In other words, Rabbi Zeira's understanding, right, where he says, no, the oath is actually go to the plaintiff. The idea there is that because there's like a moda b'miksat, right, initially, the oath was with the defendant, but it gets shifted to the plaintiff, and that's rabbinic, okay? But here, what we're trying to say that Rav Nachman does here, okay, is that initially, the initial oath is actually rabbinic, okay? And that, you know, that we can't actually have the shift here. So the Gemara now says why Abaye would actually object to Rabbi Zeira that this shepherd couldn't swear, right, because of his status as a thief, because even if he's not a confirmed thief, right, it's only, even if he hadn't been a confirmed thief, right, he is still disqualified from swearing. V'tipukle d'havei le'ro'eh, right? It should come out that the shepherd is disqualified from swearing because he is a shepherd. V'amar Rav Yehuda stam ro'eh pasul. An ordinary shepherd is disqualified from being a witness. In other words, when Abai says to Rabbi Zeira, right, how could the shepherd have to swear at all? Actually, the better objection, or really the thing that we should be, Abai's objection doesn't even make sense, because we actually have the statement from Rav Yehuda that a shepherd, right, is disqualified as a shepherd is disqualified as a witness, even if there isn't any evidence that he's a thief, because we assume that shepherds probably allow their animals to graze in other people's fields, and that's stealing. So in other words, shepherds are in a category of people we just basically, we don't trust them. So the Gemara says, lo kasha, this isn't a difficulty. Hadidei, this ruling that an ordinary shepherd is disqualified applies when the animals that he grazes are his own. Hada'ama, but this case of Rabbi Zeira, which was a shepherd who grazed the animals of the general public, right, of other people, this type of shepherd, it's not so clear, okay, that he actually is disqualified, because essentially what our understanding is that a person is only going to sin unless he has something to gain from it. So in other words, a shepherd will graze his own animals in somebody else's fields because he profits from it, right? His animals are going to be fed. But somebody who's watching other people's animals to eat, right, like this type of public shepherd who's basically just paid for the time that he cares for the animals that are given to him, he doesn't gain anything by letting those animals graze, in other people's fields. So the public shepherd wouldn't necessarily be disqualified. So then the Gemara says, "Di'ilo te'mahachi." For if you do not say this, that there is this distinction between a private shepherd and a public shepherd, right? Or rather, we say that all shepherds are thieves and we don't trust them at all. Anan chevata l'roa hechi masrinan. Then how do we allow ourselves to entrust our animals to a public shepherd at all? In other words, the whole idea that this whole case is predicated on, that people were giving their animals to a shepherd and there was a witness there to say, oh, we know that witnesses were there to say, you know, watch the animals being given over. But the idea that you could use a public shepherd at all, v'hakatif lifnei yiver lo titein mechshol, right? The Torah says, and this is a very famous pasuk from Vayikra chapter 19, verse 14, which says, don't place a stumbling block in front of the blind. But basically, we interpret this to usually mean, don't create a situation, right, where somebody, that will cause somebody to sin, right? Like, we're thinking this is like being morally blind, that we don't cause somebody to stumble. So if we know that all shepherds are thieves, right, then you wouldn't even be allowed to give a public shepherd your animals, because the assumption is that the shepherd, of course, is going to allow those animals to graze somewhere else. So that would fall under Lifnei Iver Lo Titech Mechshol. Ela Chazaka Ein Adam Chotev Lo Lo. Rather, there's a presumption that a person does not sin if they do not get any benefit. And therefore, the public shepherd is not presumed to actually be a thief. So I think we have two very interesting things here. And I'm going to go a little bit out of order. First of all, I think this end discussion here about the nature, I'm going to say there's three interesting things here. First of all, this whole status and this category of a shepherd, that a private shepherd is someone who's generally not trustworthy and we can't accept as a witness, is interesting. The second piece is this understanding of lifnei iver lo titein mechshol, right? That we see its broad application here in this passage of the Gemara. And third, that we finally see, and I know I'm sort of working backwards through the Gemara here, but we see an actual application of Rabbi Chiya's idea that when there's a moda b'miksat situation, right, somebody may need to take a shvua, but it's interesting to see that to Rabbi Zeira, it's not the defendant, but it's actually going to be the plaintiff. And that's like an interesting application of what Rabbi Chiya is saying here.
So I like this distinction between the private shepherd and the public shepherd. I'm a little intrigued that there's no mention of, you know, our Jewish historical shepherds like, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, where, you know, nobody comes and says in the Gemara, well, no, shepherds would never let an animal graze in an area that's not theirs. Because I'm guessing that that's because everybody kind of knew that this was a possibility, it was a risk. But it's interesting to me that they don't, there's no protest of that idea. Okay, I want to take up a piece on, I'm on Amud Bet. It goes back, we're going back to the Mishnah on this case of two people holding onto the same garment, you know, each one having an equal amount of the garment in their hands. That's why I think the example that's always given is the talit, because it's such an easy thing to understand exactly how that's half and half, right? Divided in half. Right? We've got a case where the one person is standing and holding half of the garment. And this one, the other one, two people are holding a half of a garment. Shavua zolama. The Gemara says, why do you need an oath? Why do you need to swear in that case? It's very clear who's holding which part of the garment and who's denying the ownership of the other party, right? Like, there's no ambiguity there. It's a physical example. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Shavua zu takanat chachamimhi. So Rabbi Yochanan explains that this was a decree that was established by the sages to make sure shelo yehei kol echad v'echad holech v'tokeif b'talito shel chaveiro v'omer shelihu, that people don't wander around picking up stuff that belongs to other people. Literally, it says the talit of other people, and saying, this is mine, right? Like, if you have to take an oath, and clearly oath-taking was something that was considered very serious, to swear in the name of God, apparently, you know, instilled fear, right? It was a kind of thing that people did not want to do, certainly not in a casual kind of way. I feel like the use of language and the use of swearing here is also something that's a bit foreign to us. Not that people don't take it seriously, you know, to swear or to affirm in a court of law, but not, it doesn't have the "that will stop you in your tracks" kind of thing that this seems to have here, where people, you know, again, the need to swear was sufficient to stop people from wandering, you know, to taking other people's stuff and claiming that it was their own. That's an important decree. My name amigod chashid amamona chashid nami ashavuata. And the Gemara says, and I'm sure somebody here has been wondering this question, why wouldn't you say that just because, you know, why would you trust that he's not going to lie in the oath if he's willing to claim that the property doesn't belong to him, right? If you're going to be chashid amamona, suspect with regard to property, why wouldn't you also be suspect with regard to the shvuah that you're going to take the oath? You know, maybe we should say that kind of person isn't believed in their oath to begin with. But the Gemara says, and again, this is one of those statements that I really appreciate, lo amrinim migo de chashid amamona chashid ashvuata. The Gemara says, no, we don't say that. We don't suspect that just because a person might be dishonest when it comes to property, that they're also going to be dishonest when it comes to taking the name of God in vain, right? Meaning, the presumption is that, like, being false, stealing property, is it's a given that that is a much lesser offense than taking a false oath. And a false oath is considered so severe that you would not presume that somebody who's willing to steal property would automatically also be willing to lie, not just lie, but to take an oath in the name of God that was not accurate, that was not true. De'ilo teme hachi, hadza amar rachmana moda miksa tata ana yishava, name amigo de chashira mamona chashira shwata. And this rationale, right, the recognition that believing in the trust, trusting in one's oath in the name of God is more trustworthy, let's say, than a person's willingness to steal, is essential to the whole concept of moda b'miksa, that the person who agrees with to part of the claim, admits to part of the claim, that person is going to take an oath, like, that only works on the assumption that the person who has to take an oath under those circumstances is also not going to lie in that oath, right? If you're going to be dishonest then what advantage do you have from swearing to the fact that you are, you know, telling the truth when you are moda b'miksa, when you're acknowledging or admitting to the partial claim? Okay, now I want to jump down a little further on the same Amud, you know, on Amud Bet of Daf Hey. The Gemara goes through different cases with the Shomrim, with these different guardians, right? And lower on the Daf, it says, what happens when you have somebody who denies having been given that deposit? So the Gemara says, "Ihach Yaakov fer b'pikadon, amai pasul edut." Somebody who denies receiving that deposit is then disqualified from bearing witness. So the Gemara asks, "Why is that?" Name ishtemuti kamishtamet savar ad de vachashna umishkachna le. Right, the Gemara says, well, let's say that the same way that he's avoiding the person who gave him this thing to watch, says, well, you know, I'll avoid him until I can look and find the item that I'm supposed to be watching, and then I'll come clean, right? So on the one hand, that might be practical, a practical solution, but it means that we've got something dishonest going on, and that's going to disqualify the person for giving testimony. So the Gemara goes on, ki amrina na kofer b'pikadon pasule idut, kigon da'atu sahade va'asaidu be, dahi shata aitel pikadon b'beite v'havayada. The case then becomes, you know, somebody says that they were never given the thing to watch, to guard, to protect. And rather than this being a case of, oh, I can't find it, but then I'll scurry and I'll find it in time to give it back, this is a case where there were witnesses to say that, in fact, that this item was left in his care. And so when he's denying that it ever was put in his care, there is contradictory evidence against his claim that he never got it. And so the issue is that, you know, he knew that it was there, it was given to him in his house, and the witness testimony then is considered enough to call into question his denial. Inami da havanaki le bide, or, you know, maybe even it was that he had it in his hand, not just in the house. So he's not buying time. It sounds like then he knew he had it, and maybe he just wants to keep the item, meaning he's denying that he ever had it in a way that is, in fact, slimy, right? Not just self-protection to buy time to be able to find it again, to give it back in time. The question is, how far does this dishonesty go? So the Gemara explains, Alahad amar Rav Huna, mashbi'ino to shvu'a she'ina birshuto. So give him an oath, right? You're going to give him an oath that he really never had it. Now, one second. We've just said that he's, you know, suspected here of dishonesty, right? And if he's suspected of his, you know, dishonesty, shouldn't we not be giving him an oath? And the answer is, well, Neima migo de chashid mamona chashid ashvuata. There are cases in which somebody who is suspected of financial dishonesty is not going to be treated as honest enough to be swearing. But in this case, like the case above, right, we have a situation where, no, you can give an oath to somebody who's claiming that they don't have the property, because just because he's suspected of being dishonest, you know, maybe he's not going to be, I'm sorry, if we want to say that this goes back to the previous case where we say just because somebody is suspected of being dishonest with regard to property, it doesn't mean that we're going to suspect them with regard to the oath. In this case, it seems that there does seem to be a concern, right? What if we were to say that because we suspect him for the property, we also would suspect him for the oath? Hatam nami morev amar dame ka yahav nele. So the Gemara says, well, when we're talking about a guardian, a shomer, who we're not really worrying that he's like literally gone and stolen the item. Right? It's got to be something where there's some way for him to kind of rationalize it, right? Where he can say to himself, well, they brought it to me, right? So I gave him money for it, right? I paid him for the right to this, to use this item, let's say. And so the moment all the wiggle room for this shomer, for the guardian, is really about property, then we don't distrust his word. And so that seems to be, you know, why it would be an acceptable situation, again, for even the shomer to take an oath, to take the oath that he never had the item, because he's not going to lie in that case if he's really just trying to, I don't know, finagle the possession of this item for himself. I'm still very interested in the presumptions, the givens of the Gemara. They know that people could be dishonest. They know that people are, that there are such people who are willing to swear falsely. And the question of when you draw the distinction and say, we're not going to worry about your falsehood with regard to property as affecting your truth telling when it comes to an oath, right? That I think is, it's a fine line. And this stuff kind of illustrates the distinctions of when to trust. When to trust specifically somebody who has already or is already suspected of being dishonest, but in a narrower sense, not that they are altogether fully dishonest in every way. That's our DAF discussion for the day. Thank you for joining us. Rank us, review us where you get your podcasts. Come talk to us on our Facebook page and tell us what you think of this DAF. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. And until tomorrow, go and learn.